1 week after Iranian gas pipelines are blown up in acts of sabotage, there is no official word on who did it. We ask an international security analyst how the saboteurs were able to damage critical Iranian infrastructure.
This is something that was done by a group that was well developed within Iranian territory.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen tells us how Iran enables its Houthi proxies to attack Red Sea shipping. We'll hear from one of three Swedish Jews whom Stockholm says were targeted for assassination by Iran in a recently revealed plot. And we ask a U.S. sociologist why Iran's disgruntled workers and retirees have been able to stage frequent small-scale protests.
They want to make a living, but they're not after trying to topple the government. They're not about that.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran has blamed sabotage for explosions that damaged major gas pipelines in two western regions on February 14th. No group has claimed responsibility for the blasts that Iranian authorities said briefly disrupted gas supplies in Chermahal and Bakhtiari province and Fars province. Video clips posted on social media by citizen journalists shortly after the explosions showed large fires burning in the pre-dawn hours above what appeared to be pipelines in western Iran. VOA could not verify the videos independently. Shaheen Modares is a security analyst at the Center for Middle East and Global Order. I asked him by phone how the Iranian government has responded to the pipeline attacks.
Well, we have two main protocols when it comes to situations like this. First one is to do the crisis management, which is something that doesn't exist within the Islamic Republic of Iran, because mostly we are talking about uneducated people in different political positions who have not learned anything about crisis management and what are the means that they need to conduct. And the second matter that is quite crucial is clear communication in cases like this, which is again something very difficult within the Islamic Republic because of the disinformation system that exists. So right after the explosion, it was called that this was not a sabotage, it was just an accident. Then after they said, yeah, it appears to be a sabotage. And then different narrations about what caused the sabotage causes disinformation, and that is exactly what the Islamic Republic wants.
Why does it want that?
They want that because they inherited this system of disinformation from the Soviet Union, and they use it as a mean to make sure that the public cannot get a hold of the true knowledge and the true sense of events that has been happening. They try to conduct a war of narrations by controlling the main narrations within society.
Well, what capabilities does the Iranian government have to try to prevent future sabotage attacks like the one we saw last week?
When we talk about sabotage attacks like this, we are talking about attacks against critical infrastructures. When it comes to critical infrastructures, we have, again, two protocols. We have a detection phase and we have the maintenance phase. During the detection phase, intelligence agencies must do risk assessments to understand what are the weak points within the critical infrastructures and how they might be hit and what should be the response. This is not happening within the Islamic Republic because they have created different intelligence agencies working in a parallel manner with other intelligence agencies.
So you're saying essentially they're working at cross purposes. They're not coordinating. Is that right?
They are not coordinating at all because each new intelligence agency has two objectives, mostly two goals. First, to conduct research and intelligence activity. And second, which is more important, is that within a totalitarian regime like Iran, they need to have more surveillance on the prior intelligence agencies. So they are not coordinating at all, and that is the reason why the detection phase has failed in Iran. The second phase, which is the maintenance, needs technological means and technological methods in order to observe and surveil the critical infrastructures and make sure that they are functioning. In developed countries, this is something that, for example, for the gas pipelines is being done with the satellites and with drones. However, within the Islamic Republic, the technology that exists is used for the proxy groups and ideological means instead of maintenance of the critical infrastructures.
Well, the New York Times reported a few days after the sabotage incidents that several unnamed U.S. and Iranian officials were pointing the finger at Israel as the party behind those incidents. But Iran itself has not publicly named any particular culprit. Why do you think that is?
First of all, I think because that could be a scandal for them. But we still don't know if it was Israel for sure. And when you look at the modus operandi of these explosions, they were quite precise, and this was a very clean job, which sounds like the Israeli operation. But at the same time, you should consider that so far, Israel has only hit military and nuclear sites and people of interest within Iran, not critical infrastructures.
That's a good point. Why would Israel do that? Is there a motive?
Because they're trying to show that we are even capable of hitting your critical infrastructures if necessary. Israel is somehow trying to prevent Iran's further actions by showing their infiltration within the system and by showing their operational means. Because when you look at this operation, what you understand is due to technicalities and the intelligence support and the operational support, this is something that was done by a group that was well developed within Iranian territory. And this was a clear sign for them that in case that is necessary, we are able to hit your critical infrastructures.
Just to kind of wrap up here, how have these incidents been affecting public opinion in Iran as you observe social media?
People call this an intelligence turmoil. They believe that the intelligence system within the Islamic Republic have been destroyed and has been infiltrated on a level that they are not capable of even performing their daily routines and the norms that they should do regarding the critical infrastructures, for instance. They understand this from the fact that most of the Islamic Republic's operations against Israel and against Israeli citizens, even in other countries, they were somehow found out about before the operation takes action, and they were neutralized. And people know very well that the Islamic Republic's intelligence system is a complete failure at this level. However, this has another aspect as well, because the reduction of the flow of gas to the major cities such as Tehran, Isfahan, it creates social unrest. And that is another factor that they are afraid of.
Well, Shaheen Modaris, an international security analyst with the Center for Middle East and Global Order, joining us on the line from Rome, Italy. Thank you very much for speaking with Flashpoint Iran.
It was my pleasure.
Yemen's Iran-backed Houthis scored two significant hits against Red Sea shipping and U.S. military targets on Monday. The U.S.-designated terrorist group struck and disabled a Belize-flagged bulk carrier with a ballistic missile in one of its most serious attacks in 4 months of strikes on commercial vessels. In the other incident, the Pentagon said a Houthi missile apparently brought down a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone off the coast of Yemen. It would be the second such loss to the Houthis since November. U.S.-led forces have carried out frequent strikes on the Houthis for a month to try to stop their shipping assaults. U.S. envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, discussed the attacks with VOA Persian correspondent Geeta Aryan at the State Department last Friday. Here's what he had to say about their connection to Iran.
The Iranians are supporting, aiding, assisting in these attacks in a most destructive way, and we would like to see the Iranians play a responsible role here, helping to de-escalate this conflict rather than fuel it further.
You've said that the IRGC helps the Houthis determine the most lucrative targets, and so has Vice Admiral Cooper with CENTCOM. Is there proof that the United States can provide to any international entity to put more pressure on the Houthis to stop it?
I think that we certainly could do that, but the proof is also visible to anybody. We have seized in the last 2 weeks three dhows of these small boats that are loaded with weapons coming from Iran into Yemen. Fortunately, there is a naval presence out in this area to intercept these ships, which are in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, this type of smuggling. But one can see the rocket launchers, the missile parts, the communications equipment that is being supplied to the Houthis, specifically so they can continue conducting attacks on Red Sea shipping. And by the way, the Houthis attacked a week ago a ship that was loaded with corn for the Iranian people. So that's why we say this is reckless and indiscriminate and hurts individuals and nations all around the region.
Iran and Saudi Arabia recently reestablished their diplomatic relations. Does the Saudi government reach out to the Islamic Republic of Iran just for this purpose?
Oh, I think so. I think it's a fundamental part of their discussion. I saw that the Saudi foreign minister and the Iranian foreign minister were just in touch on this very day. I know that the attacks on Red Sea shipping are a big concern for Saudi Arabia. This is also Saudi Arabia's economy. This is also Saudi Arabia's in proximity of Saudi Arabia. So I think they're very concerned about this effort. The Saudis have also put a great deal of effort into creating or establishing this roadmap for peace in Yemen. And I know that they're very determined to see that this roadmap gets implemented. We all want to see that. The Houthis are taking actions that are impeding the implementation of the roadmap, which hurts Yemenis at the end of the day. It hurts the Yemeni people.
That was U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, speaking with VOA Persian's Geeta Aryan. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Stockholm says a recently revealed plot in which Iranian agents allegedly planned to assassinate three Swedish Jews on Swedish territory will adversely affect relations with Tehran. In an interview with Radio Sweden last Thursday, Swedish Foreign Minister Tobias Billström said he raised the plot with Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian. Iranian state media said the phone conversation took place February 7th. Radio Sweden first revealed the plot on February 6th. It cited the Swedish prosecutor's office and police sources as saying an Iranian couple was arrested in Stockholm in April 2021 on terror charges. But it said the two were released and deported 8 months later due to insufficient evidence. The Iranian embassy in Sweden dismissed the report as imaginary in a post on the X platform. One of the Swedish Jews identified by Radio Sweden as a target of the plot is Saskia Pantel, also an Israeli citizen. She spoke to VOA Persian's digital team about how she learned that she was a target.
I think that it's very important that all of this comes up to the surface, especially in Sweden and Europe. And what happened to me and two other Swedish Jews, I believe it's unfortunate, but it's been going on for a very long time for Iranians living outside of Iran as political refugees. But what was very different about this situation is, as you mentioned, they planned to assassinate us. And I was informed while being here in Israel. I got a phone call one day from the Swedish security service, SAPO, and they basically told me that I was the target in a terror plot, which at the time sounded very unreal. But as I understood it, this is what's happening. It was extremely frightening. And I felt that, I'm safer in Israel than in Sweden. And they obviously wanted me to come back to Sweden so they could talk to me. But there's no chance I'm going back to Sweden, where because of the Swedish authorities letting these people in, my life was put in danger as a Swedish citizen.
Pantel was asked why she thinks that she was specifically targeted.
The three of us, We're all Swedish citizens, and we're also Swedish Jews. Now, I specifically have had the role as acting head of the Zionist Federation in Sweden. One of the other targets is the head of the Jewish community. And the third person, I won't tell their story, that's for them. But the way that I see it, the three of us in the state of Iran, they see us being an arm of Israel. So I see it as a very anti-Semitic crime. For me, as an activist combating anti-Semitism, it's extremely important that this is also named anti-Semitic because Jews were the target for combating anti-Semitism. But on top of that, Sweden should not have let them in. And I wish and I hope that there will be a change. There has to be some kind of consequences to this. Sweden should not have let them go. And Sweden needs to learn. They have had plenty of time. They've had since the 80s to learn, and they have failed over and over again to learn how to recognize when it is Iranian regime people coming in pretending to be somebody else with a mission to harm Swedish people, regardless if they are originally born in Iran and came as political refugees or if they are Swedish Jews, wherever they come from. I'm also immigrated to Sweden. I'm born in America. I'm a U.S. citizen. But still, Sweden has a responsibility to protect all its citizens, and that means if you're in Sweden, you should be protected by the state. And it's their responsibility to make sure that something like this does not happen to anyone.
VOA Persian also asked Pantel what message she wants to give to Iranians who do not share Tehran's hostility toward Israel.
My message for the Iranian people is that we are with you. We share the same struggles in the sense that what Israel is going through, the war that we are experiencing now, we have Iran that's backing up and training Hamas. We have Iran that's backing up and training and sending everything to Hezbollah and all the terrorist groups around us. We are surrounded by this, and we know what the Iranian people are dealing with. And I believe that it's time that the Western world, especially European countries that still have diplomatic ties, like Sweden, it's time that they truly support the Iranian people and make a mark and cut the ties, diplomatic ties, with the Iranian state and the regime that's today. Because it should not be that a country like Sweden that sees itself like leading democracy has these kind of relations with Iran, and especially if the embassy is targeting Iranians and Kurdish and Jews and anyone. It has to stop, and we need to unite, and we are united. So I want you to know that we are all with you.
I shared Pantel's comment with Iran's embassy in Sweden on Monday, but it did not respond to a request for comment. VOA Persian says social media videos posted by citizen journalists in Iran appear to show workers and retirees staging almost daily protests across the country in the past week. In one video posted by the Shpaz Nishasta Ganir Telegram channel, workers of the Iran National Steel Industrial Group could be seen marching and chanting in the southwestern city of Ahvaz. The video, which appeared to have been filmed on Tuesday, shows the men denouncing their working conditions and the dismissal of several colleagues. VOA could not independently verify its authenticity. Jessica Emami is a sociologist and Iran observer at American University. I asked her what kinds of labor protests she has been tracking in Iran.
Most of the time you'll see people gathering with signs in front of different government buildings. And to the degree that they can do that without getting badly arrested, they will do that. The problem is, especially, for example, with school teachers, they get arrested so frequently, it's almost become like there's a bail industrial complex. Like everybody gets arrested, gets out on bail, and then once you're on bail, it's like being on parole. You're controlled. There have been teachers in schools teaching with those little collar bands, the electronic bands around their ankles.
Really?
And they're teaching with those on, yes. So it's very difficult, but more often than not, that involves striking and holding signs in front of different authority buildings. It also culminates usually at May because of May Day. So now it's almost March. It's going to get more and more until May Day. And the government is always keeping their eye out for that and being more strict as May Day approaches.
Well, you do see Iranian state media covering some of these labor protests and gatherings. Why does it seem to be that the Iranian authorities tolerate this kind of activity on some level, although they do, as you did say, arrest some of those involved?
Well, the revolution itself of 1979 was pushed forward to some degree by workers' groups. And what really brought the former government down was work stoppage. Now, the reason they tolerate it is because this government was born out of strikes. And the people really believe in workers' rights. So they have to come across like, okay, we believe in workers' rights. But they're so terrified that the strikes will become political and more about bringing down the regime that that's when they start mass arresting and, you know, beating people up in jail and things like that.
One thing that's interesting to me is these kinds of labor protests have been going on in Iran for years. And in the past year and a half since the outbreak of the Women Life Freedom protest movement, there doesn't seem to be any kind of direct link or connection between workers who gather to complain about wages and benefits and the many Iranians who have been protesting for more women's rights. So why are we not seeing that kind of connection or linkage?
Yes. So I believe that the Women Life Freedom Movement was born from Gen Z. And Gen Z is really the up-and-coming generation that terrifies the regime. They want secularism. They want gender equality. They want things that they had never been born under, but knew that Iran once had those things. And they actually are the ones to most look out for. They are the ones that have, you know, 25% unemployment, even though they're all super educated. And as we've seen, the way they fight back is they will go in groups in the streets. They don't do workers' protests. My impression is that a lot of the worker protests comes out of the culture of the 1979 revolution itself. And they really just want to have their workers' rights restored. They want to make a living, but they're not after trying to topple the government. They're not about that. I think where the terrifying fear comes, as it should be, is from Gen Z and anyone under 40. The regime really has their eye on those people. And that is not through the labor movement. That's through Women Life Freedom and student groups and things like that.
Do you see any prospect of the older generation of workers joining forces with the younger Gen Z activists who are more about regime change?
I think that will only happen if we come to a tipping point where it's inevitable, and then there's going to be an avalanche. But until then, you know, people who have spent their whole life working and just want to make their life livable, I don't see them joining in until there's a tipping point. Now, it doesn't mean the tipping point is not close by. I think it is. But for now, those two movements seem to have a little bit of separation in between them. And you can see it from when you look at, for example, the retirees. They're all silver-haired and they're all very organized, but they're not saying like death to the dictator like the Gen Z people are. They're not lighting tires on fire. There's going to be the cleavage between those two groups until there is a momentum and a tipping point.
Well, Jessica Emami, adjunct sociology professor at American University, speaking on the line from the Washington, D.C. area, thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's all for our program. I'm Michael Lippin. Join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.